Chapter 33. That I was burying myself in the depths of Erebus. At last, I reached a level place, and I heard a mournful voice deliver these words, as it were, to the secret center of the earth he will mount that ascent no more. Immediately I heard arise towards me, from the depth of invisible abysses, a myriad of formidable voices united in a strange chant, let us destroy him. Let him be destroyed. What does he hear among the dead? Let him be delivered back to torture. Let him be given again to life. Then a feeble light began to pierce the darkness, and I perceived that I stood on the lowest step of a staircase, vast as the foot of a mountain. Behind me were thousands of steps of lurid iron. Before me, nothing but a void and abyss, and ether, the blue gloom of midnight beneath my feet, as above my head. I became delirious, and quitting that staircase, which method it was impossible for me to reascend, I sprung forth into the void with an execration. But, immediately, when I had uttered the curse, the void began to be filled with forms and colors, and I presently perceived that I was in a vast gallery, along which I advanced, trembling. There was still darkness round me, but the hollows of the vaults gleamed with a red light, and showed me the strange and hideous forms of their building. I did not distinguish the nearest objects, but those towards which I advanced assumed an appearance more and more ominous, and my terror increased with every step I took. The enormous pillars which supported the vault, and the tracery thereof itself, were figures of men, of supernatural stature, delivered to tortures without a name. Some hung by their feet, and, locked in the coils of monstrous serpents, clenched their teeth in the marble of the pavement. Others, fastened by their waists, were dragged upwards, these by their feet, those by their heads, towards capitals, where other figures stooped towards them, eager to torment them. Other pillars, again, represented a struggling mass of figures devouring one another, each of which only offered a trunk severed to the knees, or to the shoulders, the fierce heads whereof retained life enough to seize and devour that which was near them. There were some who, half hanging down, agonized themselves by attempting, with their upper limbs, to flay the lower moiety of their bodies, which drooped from the columns, or were attached to the pedestals, and others, who, in their fight with each other, were dragged along by morsels of flesh, grasping which, they clung to each other with a countenance of unspeakable hate and agony. Along, or rather in place of, the frieze, there were on either side a range of unclean beings, wearing the human form, but of a loathsome ugliness, busied in tearing human corpses to pieces and feasting upon their limbs and entrails. From the vault, instead of bosses and pendants, hung the crushed and wounded forms of children. As if to escape these eaters of man's flesh, they would throw themselves downwards, and be dashed to pieces on the pavement. The silence and motionlessness of the whole added to its awfulness. I became so faint with terror, that I stopped, and would fain have returned. But at that moment I heard, from the depths of the gloom through which I had passed, confused noises, like those of a multitude on its march. And the sound soon became more distinct, and the clamor fiercer, and the steps came hurrying on tumultuously at every new burst nearer, more violent, more threatening. I thought that I was pursued by this disorderly crowd, and I strove to advance, hurrying into the midst of those dismal sculptures. Then it seemed as if those figures began to heave, and to sweat blood, and their beady eyes to move in their sockets. At once I beheld that they were all looking upon me, that they were all leaning towards me, some with frightful derision, others with furious aversion. Every arm was raised against me, and they made, as though they would crush me with the quivering limbs they had torn one from the other. It is, indeed, a pity that the poor fellow gave himself the trouble to go down into damp, unwholesome graves, for the purpose of fetching up a few trumpery sheets of manuscript. And if the public has been rather tired with their contents, and is disposed to ask why Mrs. Sand's religious or irreligious notions are to be brought forward to people who are quite satisfied with their own. We can only say that this lady is the representative of a vast class of her countrymen, whom the wits and philosophers of the 18th century have brought to this condition. The leaves of the Diderot and Rousseau tree have produced this goodly fruit. Here it is, ripe, bursting, and ready to fall. And how to fall? Heaven send that it may drop easily, for all can see that the time has come. The case of Petal. In a letter to Edward Briefless Esquire, of Pump Court, Temple, Paris, November, 1839. My dear Briefless, 2 months since, when the act of accusation first appeared, containing the sum of the charges against Sebastian Petal, all Paris was in a fervor on the subject. The man's trial speedily followed, and kept for 3 days the public interest wound up to a painful point. He was found guilty of double murder at the beginning of September, and, since that time, what with Moroto's disaffection and Turkish news, we have had leisure to forget Monsieur Petal, and to occupy ourselves with Greek text omitted. Perhaps Monsieur de Balzac helped to smother what little sparks of interest might still have remained for the murderous notary. Balzac put forward a letter in his favor, so very long, so very dull, so very pompous, promising so much, and performing so little, that the Parisian public gave up Petal and his case altogether. Nor was it until today that some small feeling was raised concerning him, when the newspapers brought the account how Petal's head had been cut off at Bourg. He had gone through the usual miserable ceremonies and delays which attend what is called, in this country, the march of justice. He had made his appeal to the Court of Cassation, which had taken time to consider the verdict of the provincial court, and had confirmed it. He had made his appeal for mercy, his poor sister coming up all the way from Bourg, a sad journey, poor thing, to have an interview with the king, who had refused to see her. Last Monday morning, at 9 o'clock, an hour before Petal's breakfast, the greffier of Assize Court, in company with the cure of Bourg, waited on him, and informed him that he had only 3 hours to live. At 12 o'clock, Petal's head was off his body. An executioner from Lyons had come over the night before to assist the professional throat cutter of Bourg. I am not going to entertain you with any sentimental lamentations for this scoundrel's fate, or to declare my belief in his innocence, as Monsieur de Balzac has done. As far as moral conviction can go, the man's guilt is pretty clearly brought home to him. But any man who has read the Ausses Célèbres knows that men have been convicted and executed upon evidence 10 times more powerful than that which was brought against Petal. His own account of his horrible case may be true. There is nothing adduced in the evidence which is strong enough to overthrow it. It is a serious privilege, God knows, that society takes upon itself, at any time, to deprive one of God's creatures of existence. But when the slightest doubt remains, what a tremendous risk does it incur? In England, thank heaven, the law is more wise and more merciful. An English jury would never have taken a man's blood upon such testimony. An English judge and crown advocate would never have acted as these Frenchmen have done, the latter inflaming the public mind by exaggerated appeals to their passions. The former seeking, in every way, to draw confessions from the prisoner, to perplex and confound him, to do away, by fierce cross-questioning and bitter remarks from the bench, with any effect that his testimony might have on the jury. I don't mean to say that judges and lawyers have been more violent and inquisitorial against the unhappy Petal than against anyone else. It is the fashion of the country. A man is guilty until he proves himself to be innocent. And to batter down his defense, if he have any, there are the lawyers, with all their horrible ingenuity and their captivating passionate eloquence. It is hard thus to set the skillful and tried champions of the law against men unused to this kind of combat, Nay, give a man all the legal aid that he can purchase or procure. Still, by this plan, you take him at a cruel, unmanly disadvantage. He has to fight against the law, clogged with the dreadful weight of his presupposed guilt. Thank God that, in England, things are not managed so. However, I am not about to entertain you with ignorant disquisitions about the law. Petal's case may, nevertheless, interest you, for the tale is a very stirring and mysterious one, and you may see how easy a thing it is for a man's life to be talked away in France, if ever he should happen to fall under the suspicion of a crime. The French deed accusation begins in the following manner. Of all the events which, in these latter times, have afflicted the department of the Aisne, there is none which has caused a more profound and lively sensation than the tragical death of the lady, Félicite Alcazar, wife of Sebastian Benedict Petal, notary, at Belley. At the end of October, 1838, Madame Petal quitted that town, with her husband, and their servant Louis Ray, in order to pass a few days at Macon. At midnight, the inhabitants of Belley were suddenly awakened by the arrival of Monsieur Petal, by his cries, and by the signs which he exhibited of the most lively agitation. He implored the succors of all the physicians in the town, knocked violently at their doors, rung at the bells of their houses with a sort of frenzy, and announced that his wife, stretched out, and dying, in his carriage, had just been shot, on the Lyons Road, by his domestic, whose life Petal himself had taken. At this recital a number of persons assembled, and what a spectacle was presented to their eyes. A young woman lay at the bottom of a carriage, deprived of life. Her whole body was wet, and seemed as if it had just been plunged into the water. She appeared to be severely wounded in the face, and her garments, which were raised up, in spite of the cold and rainy weather, left the upper part of her knees almost entirely exposed. At the sight of this half-naked and inanimate body, all the spectators were affected. People said that the first duty to pay to a dying woman was to preserve her from the cold, to cover her. A physician examined the body. He declared that all remedies were useless, that Madame Petal was dead and cold. The entreaties of Petal were redoubled. He demanded fresh succors, and, giving no heed to the fatal assurance which had just been given him, required that all the physicians in the place should be sent for. A scene so strange and so melancholy, the incoherent account given by Petal of the murder of his wife, his extraordinary movements, and the avowal which he continued to make, that he had dispatched the murderer, Ray, with strokes of his hammer, excited the attention of Lieutenant Wolfe, commandant of gendarmes. That officer gave orders for the immediate arrest of Petal, but the latter threw himself into the arms of a friend, who interceded for him, and begged the police not immediately to seize upon his person. The corpse of Madame Petal was transported to her apartment. The bleeding body of the domestic was likewise brought from the road, where it lay, and Petal, asked to explain the circumstance, did so. Now, as there is little reason to tell the reader, when an English counsel has to prosecute a prisoner on the part of the Crown for a capital offense, he produces the articles of his accusation in the most moderate terms, and especially warns the jury to give the accused person the benefit of every possible doubt that the evidence may give, or may leave. See how these things are managed in France, and how differently the French counsel for the Crown sets about his work. He first prepares his act of accusation, the opening of which we have just read. It is published 6 days before the trial, so that an unimpassioned, unprejudiced jury has ample time to study it, and to form its opinions accordingly, and to go into court with a happy, just prepossession against the prisoner. Read the first part of the Petal Act of Accusation. It is as turgid and declamatory as a bad romance, and as inflated as a newspaper document by an unlimited penny a liner. The Department of the Aisne is in a dreadful state of excitement. The inhabitants of Billy come trooping from their beds, and what a sight do they behold! A young woman at the bottom of a carriage, tout rousselant, just out of a river, her garments, in spite of the cold and rain, raised, so as to leave the upper part of her knees entirely exposed, at which all the beholders were affected, and cried, that the first duty was to cover her from the cold. This settles the case at once. The first duty of a man, is to cover the legs of the sufferer, the second to call for help. The eloquent substitute du procureur du roi has prejudged the case, in the course of a few sentences. He is putting his readers, among whom his future jury is to be found, into a proper state of mind. He works on them with pathetic description, just as a romance writer would. The rain pours in torrents. It is a dreary evening in November. The young creature's situation is neatly described. The distrust which entered into the breast of the keen old officer of gendarmes strongly painted, the suspicions which might, or might not, have been entertained by the inhabitants, eloquently argued. How did the advocate know that the people had such? Did all the bystanders say aloud, I suspect that this is a case of murder by Monsieur Petel, and that his story about the domestic is all deception? Or did they go off to the mayor, and register their suspicion, or was the advocate there to hear them? Not he, but he paints you the whole scene, as though it had existed, and gives full accounts of suspicions, as if they had been facts, positive, patent, staring, that everybody could see and swear to. Having thus primed his audience, and prepared them for the testimony of the accused party, now, says he, with a fine show of justice, let us hear Monsieur Petel, and that worthy's narrative is given as follows. He said that he had left Macon on the 31st October, at 11 o'clock in the morning, in order to return to Belly, with his wife and servant. The latter drove, or led, an open car. He himself was driving his wife in a four-wheeled carriage, drawn by one horse. They reached Bourg at 5 o'clock in the evening, left it at 7, to sleep at Pontaine, where they did not arrive before midnight. During the journey, Petel thought he remarked that Ray had slackened his horse's pace. When they alighted at the inn, Petel bade him deposit in his chamber 7,500 francs, which he carried with him, but the domestic refused to do so, saying that the inn gates were secure, and there was no danger. Petel was, therefore, obliged to carry his money upstairs himself. The next day, the 1st November, they set out on their journey again, at 9 o'clock in the morning. Louis did not come, according to custom, to take his master's orders. They arrived at 10 a. about 3, stopped there a couple of hours to dine, and it was 8 o'clock when they reached the Bourg of Rossillon, where they waited half an hour to bait the horses. As they left Rossillon, the weather became bad, and the rain began to fall. Petel told his domestic to get a covering for the articles in the open chariot, but Ray refused to do so, adding, in an ironical tone, that the weather was fine. For some days past, Petel had remarked that his servant was gloomy, and scarcely spoke at all. After they had gone about 500 paces beyond the bridge of Andert, that crosses the river Furens, and ascended to the least steep part of the hill of Dard, Petel cried out to his servant, who was seated in the car, to come down from it, and finish the ascent on foot. At this moment a violent wind was blowing from the south, and the rain was falling heavily. Petel was seated back in the right corner of the carriage, and his wife, who was close to him, was asleep, with her head on his left shoulder. All of a sudden he heard the report of a firearm. He had seen the light of it at some paces distance, and Madame Petel cried out, "My poor husband, take your pistols." Apostrophe the horse was frightened, and began to trot. Petel immediately drew the pistol, and fired, from the interior of the carriage, upon an individual whom he saw running by the side of the road. Not knowing, as yet, that his wife had been hit, he jumped out on Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.